What's the most frightening thing that's ever happened to you? Why do our childhood fears seem so real to us, and why do they survive into our adulthood? Do we really have to overcome our fears, or is it okay to just live with them? Welcome to Mind's Eye Radio, the most creative hour you'll hear on radio. I'm your host, Scott Tallman. Mind's Eye Radio comes to you from the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. In the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers tackle fear itself. You'll visit two young boys during an epidemic in the 1940s, explore what it's like growing up in an abusive household, wait anxiously as a plane careens out of control, and learn whether someone can really live without TV. All that and much more. So stay tuned for an exciting hour of fiction, essays, poetry, and drama. It is, perhaps, a blessing that most of us are able to sequester our feelings of fear in a small corner of our brain, away from conscious thought. Otherwise, we would live in mortal terror of anything that ever frightened us. But being hidden away doesn't mean our fears are forgotten. All it takes is for something, a sight, a smell, a sound, to hit the right trigger, and all the old fears come rushing back. For writer Dick Radke, that trigger is a word he learned as a boy growing up in the 1940s.
We didn't know where it came from.
Every block had kids down sick.
It was a big scare.
It was an act of God.
We didn't know how to prevent it.
There was no vaccine.
It was very frightening.
There was no cure.
Those of us who remember the 1940s also recall one simple five-letter word that was spoken with a rush of dread, a word more terrible than Frankenstein and Dracula combined. That word was polio. Early in the summer of 47, the city turned off the drinking fountains on street corners. Then they closed the swimming pools and the public beaches. 2 days before my 10th birthday, the news came over our Crosley radio. Quarantine for children under age 16. We couldn't leave our own yards. Polio stalked the city streets like a nightmare.
They'd push school dates back.
We weren't allowed to play with friends.
My mother would not allow me to go to the candy store.
We never went swimming in August.
We were kept away from all crowds.
We were forbidden to go to the movies.
It was a very long, lonely summer.
The war was over, and the rest of the world had settled down to make the most of peace. Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Egg and I made movie audiences laugh. But for a 10-year-old boy, war was closer to home than ever. Even President Roosevelt had died in a wheelchair. FDR, the man who'd asked us to give to the March of Dimes, had polio.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
With the quarantine, Harlan Schwabach and I passed time tossing tennis balls over Olszewski's yard from his porch to mine, inventing games based on our favorite baseball players. DiMaggio goes back, and makes a one-handed stab against the wall. Williams races through left center, spears the ball on the dead run, and the crowd goes wild. Yeah! Everybody was scared. The newspapers, the mayor, especially our parents. Polio was a wild beast that lurked in puddles of standing water after a summer rain, in crowded theaters, in the very air we breathed. So small you couldn't see it, the deadly bug could put you into leg braces for the rest of your life. A stiff neck was a sure sign you'd been infected. Each morning I woke up and turned my head this way and that. Each morning my neck felt funny. Determined to escape our boredom, Harlan and I snuck away to Joey Macaluso's hideout under the billboard on 60th and National, where a man with a mouth 6 feet around spewed rings of white smoke advertising Old Gold cigarettes. Joey himself, 2 years older and generations more worldly than Harlan and I, smoked Chesterfields. And when we stopped by that afternoon, he offered us a drag, passing the butt around until my stomach turned over. 3 days later, my mom got a telephone call. Mrs. Macaluso, crying. Joey had polio. I remembered the moment I'd taken the Chesterfield from Joey's hand and placed it on my lips. Take a chance like that and look at what happens. I headed for the bathroom and gargled with Listerine. Twice. One look at a picture of a kid in an iron lung was enough to swear me off drinking water in public places or sharing Joey's cigarette. The iron lung was proof of what polio could do. A stainless steel tank that kept your lungs working, it looked like Captain Nemo's one-man submarine. Squared windows on top and round portholes along the sides so the doctors could check their patient. At one end of the machine, your head stuck out and rested on a pillow so that you could see in a mirror that squared and flattened your world. Joey's picture appeared on the front page of the newspaper, smiling into the mirror above his head as though he'd just found a whole carton of Chesterfields in his dad's dresser drawer. In an instant of recognition, I saw my own face in that glass and knew that we were of a piece, Joey and I, and that in some distant time, his fate would be my own. The next morning, Harlan and I were back in our yards, comparing symptoms. My stiff neck was worse today, and Harlan had a sore throat. All morning long, we flexed our knees and swallowed through Adam's apples big as golf balls, waiting. Joey died the next week. His father told a reporter that he had been very courageous. Harlan and I were not allowed to go to the funeral because of the quarantine. We did sneak down the alley to National Avenue, though, to watch the big black hearse pull out of Sorrel and Griffith's funeral parlor.
Don't get overtired.
Don't run around too much.
Never drink from somebody else's cup.
For some reason, all the adults blamed this creek.
The people in Kansas thought that they were somewhat immune.
Rich people didn't get infantile paralysis.
To get sick was sort of a weakness of character.
7 years later, they began testing Dr. Salk's vaccine. The pictures in the paper showed kids lined up to get their shots. Children smiled bravely as the nurse punctured their arm with a needle. But after 50 years, I can still resurrect Joey's face in that mirror. And even as my grandchildren take small plastic vials of prevention, the words quarantine and iron lung, and especially polio, will forever strike fear into my heart. This is Dick Radke for Mind's Eye Radio.
My name is Virus Poliomyelitis. I cause a disease which you call infantile paralysis. I consider myself quite an artist, a sort of sculptor. I specialize in grotesques, twisting and deforming human bodies. That's why I'm called the Crippler.
For far too many children, fear is a constant in their lives, their homes, and all too often, the cause of that fear is a parent. Here we see just such a parent through the eyes of 5-year-old Rowena, the lead character in Jackie Wilson's novel, A Square Peg Life.
No, you are not going to hurt Dad's feelings this time, Rowena, snapped her sister Hazel. You are going to stop thinking of yourself and feeling sorry for yourself for once and go out there and give him a big hug. She dragged Rowena toward the kitchen door. Now you make nice for Dad, or you'll be sorry. Rowena stumbled into the doorway. Through the terror that pierced her from every side, giving everything a hazy, unreal appearance, she watched her father take off his shoes and sink into his favorite chair. Maybe he won't yell this time. Maybe he won't. I know he won't, she told herself fervently. She repeated it over and over like a magic mantra that would somehow protect her if she said it often enough. Damn it, who the hell put this paper here that I just sat on? Andrew sprang up from the chair like a bullet fired from a gun, clutching a section of the evening paper in his hand. Haven't I told you not to do this, huh? Nobody just gives a damn about the old man, do they? Who did this, huh? Camille, did you? Camille was very soothing and reassuring, as she always was with her husband when he got like this. He couldn't help being upset, and the thing to do was indulge him so he would calm down as soon as possible. No, dear, of course I didn't. I really don't know how that got there. Andrew was yelling at the top of his lungs. Well, who did it then? Now there's a section torn, damn it. Hazel, Rowena, get in here. Get in here this minute, or by God, there'll be some little butts whaled around here, there will be. Hazel came in, giving her father a shaky smile. Daddy, I didn't do it. I'm sure whoever didn't mean to. Wanting only to survive, Rowena did a fast turnaround from the doorway, stumbling for her room. When she looked up to take a breath of air, she was in the kitchen. Heart pounding and legs buckling, she collapsed by the table. For a minute, she held her breath in a vain attempt to stop the torrent of tears, but it was like trying to hold back the tide. The dam broke, and she sobbed hysterically. She heard footsteps and looked up frantically, not knowing where to go or what to do. Was she going to die now or what? What was going to happen to her? Thank God it was Mommy. Oh, Rowena, what's the matter now? You know Daddy doesn't mean any of this. He's just letting off a little steam, that's all. You should be used to this by now. Mommy, Mommy, I'm scared. No, now don't you say that. You know you're not scared of Daddy. Daddy's not mad at you, he's just nervous. Now just tell yourself you're not scared and you won't be. Now go out and talk to him and give him a big hug and everything will be fine. Rowena's mother pulled her toward the door and final annihilation. No, Mommy, I'm scared, I'm scared. Rowena clutched in blind panic onto the nearest thing she could find, a table leg. Her father came into the kitchen, seemingly calm. He saw Rowena crying and was instantly furious again. And just what is the matter with you, young lady? He bellowed. Honey, it's nothing, said his wife. Rowena fell down and banged her knee. That's why she's crying. Well, what the hell did she fall down for, huh? Stop that crying and dry it up this instant, young lady, or by God, I'll give you something to really cry about. He stomped toward his daughter, who cringed in terror and sobbed even harder. She wasn't going to survive this. She couldn't. This was it, the end of everything. Honey, please go back into the living room and read your paper, and I'll call you when supper's ready. You've had a hard enough day without this. I'll handle it. As if in answer to a prayer, Rowena saw her mother miraculously maneuver the raging giant out of the kitchen, then turn back to her. Now see what you've done? He was all calmed down until he saw you crying, and that got him all upset again. If you just wouldn't get scared, that's what sets him off. It really hurts Daddy when you act like you're scared of him, but you just never care about that, do you? As hard as she was trying to understand what her mother was saying and why her mother was mad at her for being scared of Daddy, a wave of panic was engulfing and garbling everything around her. She couldn't think of anything else to do except repeat how she felt, hoping that she could manage to say it right this time so that someone could understand. I can't help it. I'm just so scared. All right, fine. Just go ahead and be scared. Don't even think about the rest of us. Her mother turned abruptly toward the door and stalked angrily out. She never gave even a backward glance at the spent little figure on the floor, who was by now crying as much with frustration at the hopelessness of her unchanging situation as anything else. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Coming up next, a poem inspired by a sports star's plane accident and a visit with Civil War soldiers on the eve of a battle. And later, we look at what happens when our fears run away with us. Fear seldom travels alone. And helplessness, the feeling that there is absolutely nothing we can do to change the situation. This combination of fear and helplessness left its mark on poet Lynn Patrick Smith as he read about the tragic plane accident of golfer Payne Stewart in October 1999. He imagines what it must have been like for Payne's wife, Tracy.
plane carries Payne Stewart across America. Everyone on the plane, even the pilot, is sleeping. They don't notice that the windows have frosted and the automatic pilot has taken them hundreds of miles off course. Payne Stewart's wife watches accounts of the flight on TV. Military jets are flying so close to the plane, you'd think the pilot would hear them, rise from his nap, and land the plane safely in the lap of Middle America. He doesn't. She thinks what they need is a wake-up call, tries to reach her husband on his cellular phone. She calls and calls, but the ringing just won't stop. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
One amazing thing about fear is how quickly it can overtake us. You're going about your everyday life, then boom, the next thing you know, you're nearly paralyzed with fright. Here's poet Gay Davidson Zilski recalling one of these paralyzing moments that parents sometimes encounter.
Rust and clay. The day you think your child is missing, you taste the copper fear on your mute tongue like pennies on the eyes of the dead. The black bile of leaf rot is the eyes of craven scavengers dissolving gold October. All your failing eyes can see is what they did not see before, crows dissecting a string of gut, roadkill in the busy street. All you hear is the message machine hissing, is this his mother, this is who, and this is where, and this is over an hour ago. This is daycare, and he is missing. You feel the solid oak floors giving. Your words could chew the phone cord through for wanting one of his friend's folks to say, oh, yes, he just came home with Ben. We thought you knew. Or even, yes, I saw him just now with coach or teacher. When your child is missing, all the guilt of never having stressed the strangers, snakes, poisons, lures, bubbles through your pores. The vision of that pure and pretty, tantalizing road that lured you to detour impulsively just that day deserts you. The chimera of that dear security, that your only precious gift was romping in the gold and blue of schoolyard, watched over by the high, wise eyes of windows, gone. And when he's found, a ghastly hour later, on the playground, temporarily out of sight but safe, all your other earthly goods are rust and clay. This is Gay Davidson Zelsky, also known as Norma Gay Pruitt.
The intense fears we feel at times of crisis are in some ways easier to deal with than the shapeless fears that lurk in the shadows. Poet Evie Thompson takes on these haunting fears in her poem, Insomniac's Calendar.
No moon, new moon, or the wrong time of the night, like the wrong time of my life. A night of struggle with the bedclothes, body aches. Withering soul, mind twisting, bending, and fragile. Hoping for any light, I open the drapes in the pit-like dark of the living room. I sit. I wait. Worries overtake me. Old age and illness stalk me. I am to be butchered in the blackness by the leopard I cannot see. Friends and loved ones have been taken by cancer, heart attacks, embolisms. Our children age, but have yet to take hold of their lives. I sit with my fear in the dark. God, are you there? Please be present in my life. I'm hurting and afraid. I sit, I wait, as with my life I can't see anything. Then, as the iris of my eye opens, rectangles of gray appear in the windows. Lighter above, sky. The lawn differentiates, the black of the evergreens. A small animal scurries in the gloom. Inside the house, armchairs and coffee table materialize. The shape of magazines, the pattern in the oriental rug. Light out of darkness. 2 weeks later, another insomniac night. Moonlight on the drapes fills me with the awareness of the power of light reflected over immense distance. So God reaches out to me from around the corner of the earth, from the distant Magellanic clouds, or from the quiet of my living room. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer Paul Thompson takes us back to the Civil War and the eve of the Battle of the Wilderness.
This is a scene from a story that takes place in the spring of 1864 as Union forces advance into Virginia under General Grant. The main character is Johnson, a Pennsylvania farmer who volunteered for the Army after his oldest son died in battle. Johnson lies huddled in his tent next to his sleeping youthful tentmate, Cub, and worries about how he will stand up to the demands of battle. The sentries shivered and wondered if there would be frost. Johnson and Cub, fully clothed and booted, shared their thin blankets. Johnson listened to Cub's light snore. Tilting his head back, he saw, through the tent opening, a patch of clear sky and three stars. An owl hooted. Another, more distant, responded. From a nearby tent came a louder, coarser hooting. The next tent picked it up. Soon the camp rang with hoots. Someone brayed like a mule, and a wave of braying swept over the battalion, to be followed by cockle-doodle-doos, baas, barks. Surly officers, woken from sleep, yelled for quiet, but the uproar subsided only gradually. Eventually, though, all was quiet again, and the two owls resumed their melancholy conversation. Cub snored through all this. Sleeping was one of his talents. Johnson, whose thoughts had been momentarily diverted, returned to his worries. Back on the farm, he had hunted with a shotgun, and at training camp he had drilled with a rifled musket the Army provided him. You tried to hold the heavy musket steady, squinting at the target barrel 150 yards away. You pulled the trigger and the stock slammed into your shoulder. Some new recruits were knocked flat. Reload, a complex process involving paper cartridges with powder and bullet, ramrod, firing cap, all supposed to be done in 20 seconds. You fired kneeling, prone, rolling over onto your back to reload. Many times he spilled the powder, had to reach again to his cartridge box. Could he remember to do all that with bullets singing past him and cannons roaring? And could he deliberately aim and kill another man? Then there was bayonet drill, lunging, jumping, swinging. He had slaughtered many farm animals, but plunging a bayonet into a man's belly? Several weeks earlier, in winter camp, he had shared his fears with a sergeant, as they stood in the mud a little apart from the company. "I can accept death, Sergeant. We all die. That is God's judgment on our disobedience. I fear death less than ever, now that I've lost my son to this terrible war, for I live in hope Robert and I will be united again in the hereafter." "He was a good man," the sergeant said. "I knew him only slightly, But Sergeant Michaels of Company C told me once your son had a good head on his shoulders and was firm in a fight. Johnson bowed his head. I feel I must finish his work, but I doubt my ability. The idea of killing another man is so repugnant to me that I fear I'll be unable to do it when the time comes. The sergeant was silent for a moment. War is the damnedest thing, Johnson. It asks you to do things no sane man would do in civilian life. And you wouldn't do them in war, neither, except you get a little insane when you're in battle. After the first volley or two, the fear and horror of it fades away, and the heat gets in your blood, and all you care about is killing the enemy. Of course, that's all he cares about, too. Johnny Reb's a mighty good fighter. He laid his hand on Johnson's shoulder. You're a steady man. You'll do what's right. The conversation had reassured the farmer at the time, but now that they were actually marching toward the rebels, his doubts mounted again. He continued to fret as the three stars in the tent opening gradually shifted their positions. Finally, as he always did, he turned to prayer. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. The air was colder still. Cub pressed against him, and Johnson welcomed the warmth. The army was a democracy of shared pallets, lice, fleas, and filth. He thought of his wife propped up on the pillows of their bed. In her most recent letter, she had written that it was now her custom to light her way to bed with a candle stub. She did not blow the candle out, but as she fell asleep, let it burn itself to darkness. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Paul Thompson.
Commentator Karen Schultz was recently struck by the notion that maybe fences aren't used to keep something in as much as they are to keep things out. And she wondered what it was that people were so afraid of. Here she is with her essay, Fear and Possibly Loathing.
Good fences make good neighbors, Robert Frost said. But frankly, I'm convinced good neighbors make bad fences. Fences are supposed to keep out and keep in, but never allow passing through. Some are wooden, some wire, some 6 feet, some four, but they are always a distinct barrier. So what is it folks are afraid might come traipsing past their door? Maybe it's kids like me growing up in Pennsylvania. I can remember my route to school clearly, through our backyard, to the McGimpsies, past their doghouse, over the Dougherty's garden, to their front yard, and onto the sidewalk. Funny enough, no one complained. Often enough, I received an afternoon greeting from Mrs. McGimpsey. Now if I go back to my childhood home, I might find that path to school lined with fences. All across the country, the rage is to barricade, and not just because of small city spaces. Driving down 191 from Bozeman to Big Sky in Montana, I saw Ted Turner's acres upon acres lined with wooden crisscrosses. Sure, there's a ranch on a few of those acres, but I didn't see anything roaming for miles. What's he afraid of? That someone might traverse his land, which ironically was part public property before it was rezoned? Don't get me wrong. I understand the privacy issue here and the, quote, what's mine is mine concern. But what I don't understand is the fear that seems implied by fences. So what if your dog finds his way onto my lawn? Is it scary that I might pet him? Okay, maybe some people don't like dogs, but hey, their owners have ears too. Why put up a barrier when you can have communication? That might be the key here. Fences keep us from communicating because they talk for themselves. You know, like those pseudo gates in front of newer home communities. I can hear them loud and clear. They say things like, "What year is that car? Are you a doctor? Do you belong here?" My neighbor's gray, 4-foot fence says, "Hey, let's talk, but watch out for my potatoes." Regardless, the message is relayed by the fence, not the owner. Perhaps we're all afraid to communicate the difficult things, like, "I don't want your kind in my neighborhood," "I don't trust you," or "My property is more valuable than yours," or "My business is none of yours." Or perhaps we don't think we're communicating at all. But trust me, I can hear your fences, and baby, it ain't love. This is Karen Schultz for Mind's Eye Radio.
To poet Esther Cameron, the fear of our fellow humans seems evident in all the marginalized people we've created in our society. Those who by some criteria don't fit into the mainstream. In her poem, Superfluous People, she finds there may be a way for us to overcome those fears.
Superfluous people. We are the superfluous people. We are the unionized workers replaced by robots or slaves, the secretaries ousted by computers. We are the people of color, the over 50, the people with disabilities, the ones who don't belong on the team. We are the displaced homemakers, the parentless children, the partnerless parents, the poets without readers, the teachers without students, the students who can't afford college, the graduates who didn't get hired, the scientists without grants, the executives who got downsized. Why is this? Isn't there enough work to do in the world? Aren't there enough stomachs to be filled, enough limbs to be clothed, enough babes to be rocked, enough children and youth to be taught, enough neighborhoods to be beautified, enough trees to be planted, enough fields to be tilled, enough songs to be sung, enough stories to be told, enough riddles to be solved, enough wounds to be healed, enough houses and cities to be built right? But the market does not ask these questions. The market cannot ask what people need. It can only ask what those who have the money want. Only community can ask what people need. And time may be short. As slave labor replaces free, as machines replace people, as large corporations swallow up small ones and cut their staffs and buy up the press and the government, I tell you, spaceship Earth is flying with a shrinking crew, a skeleton crew with skeleton motives, and the rest of us are not passengers. We are ballast, and we feel the moment edging closer when we could be pushed off. But let's keep our heads, my friends. Let us put them together. Together, let us learn to ask the question what we, the people, need. We are the superfluous people. Nobody needs us, except ourselves. But if you'll say you need me, I'll say I need you. And we can start. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Esther Cameron.
Suppose your fears were turned upside down. that you were taught at a young age to fear what others love. Amazingly enough, that premise was the subject of an actual psychological experiment in 1920 by behavioral psychologist John Watson. The child was little Albert B., an 11-month-old boy, the son of a midwife who worked at the hospital where Watson was doing his research. There, little Albert learned to fear white, furry objects. Kelly Warren discovered the little lab experiment, now 80 years old, living in the sewers of Baltimore.
Tell me what you remember of the famous fear experiments conducted on you as a baby.
In the spring of 1918, the great John Watson and the lovely Rosalie Rayner, to whom he was married later, initiated a series of experiments where I was the primary subject. The hypothesis of the Dr. Watson was that fear could be induced, and induced in a human subject. He intended to induce this fear by following the precepts of the great Pavlov, using the association behavioral technique. Dr. Watson prosecuted this experiment by striking a metal bar loudly against the side of the crib where I was sleeping, sending me into a torrent of terror. But the loud ringing of the metal was the single thing that frightened me at the time. Apparently, I was chosen because of my sturdy disposition. I showed no fear or aversion to any particular object, be it spiders or snakes or rats. But the single thing that frightened me and sent me into fear and fearful screams was the striking of the loud metal against the crib edge behind my head.
Wasn't there this white rat put into your crib?
Yes, apparently. The fact was that the rat was placed in my crib, and I showed nothing but a healthy, childlike curiosity. I extended my hands and sought to touch the tiny creature. The thought now sends waves of nausea and revulsion through my body. But apparently at the time, I showed nothing but a childlike curiosity for these creatures. After a number of days, I think it was merely 10 or 11 days of this repeated procedure, I developed the same reaction of total fear at the sight of the rat, without the striking of the metal bar at all. Soon the experiment was extended to include rats and rabbits, Santa Claus masks with the curly, soft texture of white synthetic hairs.
Little Albert, are you okay?
Yes, I sealskin coats and the hair of dogs. All of these would induce the same sense of intense fear in me as you can see. The fear response is 80 years later alive in me today.
Now, I want to quickly read a lab note here that Watson and Rayner noted in 1920. The first one, white rat suddenly taken from the basket and presented to Albert. He began to reach for the rat with left hand. Just as his hand touched the animal, the bar was struck immediately behind his head. The infant jumped violently and fell forward, burying his face in the mattress.
Yes.
He did not cry, however. On the second experiment, just as the right hand touched the rat, the bar was struck again. Again, the infant jumped violently, fell forward, and began to whimper.
Yes.
So they performed these for two more days over a period of time until they were able to only put the rat...
Wait, did you see that over there?
What?
So
after 2 days of doing this, they presented the rat to you alone, without the loud noise. And I'd like to read this note here, this lab note. Actually, why don't you read it for me? The italicized.
Oh, it has been so long since I looked at the real lab notes. The instant the rat was shown, the baby began to cry. Almost instantly, he turned sharply to the left, fell over on the left side, raised himself on all fours, and began to crawl away so rapidly. So rapidly, he was caught with difficulty before reaching the edge of the table.
Now, do you... Do you still harbor these... Obviously you do. But do you think that these fears are irrational? Do you think that you harbor irrational fears?
Miss Warren, the great John Watson was no fool. He believed that all fears could be learned, and by inference, could be unlearned. One thing that I have learned from this experience, this bitter experience, is the shining wisdom of John Watson's teaching. Yes, my fears are irrational, and yet all fears are irrational. If we can learn to fear anything, we can also learn to fear nothing. I would go further and say that fear itself lost its reality with the work of John Watson. Unfortunately, I've been unsuccessful in unlearning the fears that the doctor has so graciously instructed me to savor over these low so many years.
Did you ever meet John Watson?
No, I never met the man. Although I have followed the case of his work and others over the years, historians of record maintained after my experiments that the fear triggers were limited to the original rat, rabbit, Santa Claus mask, sealskin coat, and dog. However, I know this to be not true. The items that induce the same nauseous paroxysms of fear have seemed to have expanded exponentially from rat to mouse to kangaroo and all things marsupial. Clouds and pipe smoke, false beards, all the entire world of the soft and cuddly, of the smooth and comforting, induces the deepest paroxysms of nauseous terror in me today.
So what kind of life did you lead prior to ending up here in the sewers of Baltimore?
Well, I pursued the one career that seemed to offer maximum opportunity for not encountering the soft and furry. I became a steel worker, devoting my days and nights working in the presence of molten alloys, shining steel, dark, smooth surfaces, devoid of the soft and furry.
Do you think an experiment like this, what John B. Watson did with you in the 20s, could be repeated today?
I hope not. I sincerely hope not. Unless the fears induced could be turned off as freely as they seem to have been turned on. Unfortunately, the switch, in my experience and in the general human condition, always seems to be stuck in one direction, and that is to our everlasting dread and discontent.
Well, I have to say that I pity you in a way. I feel sorry for you.
Consider this. If life hands you a repulsive little furry bunny of a fate, it is always within your power to touch it or to turn around and run for all you're worth. Yeah, I choose the latter every time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Little Albert, who was the lab experiment for John B. Watson, a behavioral psychologist, in the 1920s when Little Albert learned to fear a white rat and subsequently other white furry objects. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Kelly Warren in the sewers of Baltimore.
What was that? I swear there's rats down here.
Little Albert was played by Greg Willard, and you're listening to Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up next, we get at the truth behind our Y2K fears, take a comical look at the fear of not watching TV. Stay tuned. Sometimes we find that our imagined fears are real, and that our real fears are imagined. Such was the case with the recent Y2K scare. Commentator Fran Zell couldn't help but wonder why that is.
New Year's Eve, 1999. It wasn't Tokyo, London, Paris, or any of the other glittery locales that captured international media attention that night. But it was honest. "You're still alive!" a young man shouted at the top of his lungs from the middle of a frenzied outdoor celebration in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. Those of us within earshot smiled indulgently. We hadn't thought the world would really stop turning at the stroke of Y2K, had we? Of course, it isn't every New Year's Eve that the Defense Department coughs up an extra $8 million for a joint observation post in Colorado to make sure nuclear missiles don't get launched accidentally. It isn't every New Year's Eve that major airlines cancel all flights. Or that your friends say, maybe they'll come to your party and maybe they won't. It depends on whether the power grid goes down about 4 p.m., turning all the water and lights off with it, and requiring them to stay home and guard the truckloads of food they so prudently stashed in the basement. We weren't any of us really afraid of a little computer glitch, were we? Now that it's all safely behind us and the world still merrily turns, what's a few extra zeros among friends? Personally, I'm afraid of my computer all the time. All I ever wanted from it was a good word processing program. I never wanted to be a graphic artist or a webmaster or an online shopper, and I never wanted to buy a new computer every few years just to keep up with the latest technology. But I wouldn't want to compose a story on a typewriter again either. I worked for a 60-something attorney not too many years ago, and he didn't believe in spending his hardly earned money on computers. He believed IBM Selectrics were good enough for the secretaries who typed up his long-winded briefs and threatening letters. I wonder how much water and spam he stockpiled for the millennium. Okay, I admit it. I bought a little extra bottled water, you know, 2 or 3 gallons at a time over the course of a few weeks, so I wouldn't look obvious or foolish. And last summer, I snatched up this thing on sale called a double-barrel Y2K Energizer flashlight. It's supposed to burn 25% brighter than halogen. 8, yes, that's 8, AA batteries included. I didn't buy much extra food, though. We have mice. I tried to stay on good terms with the friends who did lay in provisions, but only if they also owned wood-burning stoves. Oh, yes, it's all very funny now, this fear of the unknown computer bug. It's easy to laugh now about a lifestyle that's got the best of us, about a technology we none of us really trust, and about so-called computer experts who didn't think the programs they wrote way back then would still be around today. When was that? A whole 20 years ago? That's the scary part. It's too easy to laugh. I don't know about you, but I'm holding on to my double-barrel, extra-bright flashlight. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Fran Zell, looking for something to be scared about in 2001.
Most of our fears seem to stem from losing something that we value, like our family, friends, or adored possessions. Writer Charlotte Quo Benitez wondered what would happen if one family member gave up something that the rest of the family valued dearly. Here's a short drama called Cathode Ray Deprivation.
Hello, Mrs. Rall. I'm Dr. Feelgood. Sorry to keep you waiting. I understand you have some serious concerns about your husband. When did you first notice these changes?
Well, it was on Friday. He'd been kind of chatty Thursday night, but I figured it was just, you know, mood swings or something. You know how men are. So I didn't really pay much attention. But on Friday night, he began to look, well, not quite himself.
Has this ever happened before?
I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but he had a mild case of it last year. We never came in to get him treated, though. Oh, it's all my fault. I should have done something about it then.
Now, there's no point in blaming yourself. What's important is that we nip it in the bud before it gets worse. Now, did you witness the same symptoms last year? And was it also during TV sweeps week?
Yes, but the whole thing didn't last as long. Only around a day. And then he came to his senses.
So he went back up to his normal viewing level?
Yes. Thank goodness. But this time, oh, doctor, you've got to help him.
I'll do the best I can. First, I need to find out exactly how far gone he is. Are his eyes still glazed over?
No, that's the thing. I came home on Friday, and I saw him sitting on the couch like he usually does. But his eyes looked so eerie. They were alert. It scared me. And I asked him if he was all right. But he just gave me this smile and said he'd never felt better.
And you said earlier that he had an unusual twitch. Is that in his right or left hand?
His left.
How odd.
Well, he's a lefty.
Ah, that explains it. I've only seen the twitch in right-handers. Which digits seem to be most affected?
His thumb. It just kind of does this little twitch every now and then. What's wrong with it, doctor?
This condition is the result of a lack of RCA, remote control activity. It's a normal reaction to a prolonged state of inactivity. The twitching will diminish with time. The problem is that you don't really want the twitching to stop because that means he's lost the ability to use remote controls. Now, this is a very dangerous skill to lose in our society.
Oh, I know. What can we do?
I suggest you give him a remote control to play with, something uncomplicated, like the ones for a simple TV set made in the early 80s or so. Then slowly move him up to more and more complex systems. There, Mrs. Rall, don't cry. The best scientists in the country are working hard to find a cure. You mustn't lose hope. Are there any other strange symptoms I should know about?
Well, yes. And I cringe just to remember what happened. Last night he was sitting on the couch as usual. But this time, oh, I can't even say it.
You must be strong, Mrs. Rall.
He was reading.
Reading, huh? Think about this next question very, very carefully. What was he reading?
I can't remember. It was thick, though. And I think it had a hard cover.
So it wasn't TV Guide?
No, definitely not.
Entertainment Weekly? Maybe a special issue?
No. Wait. It was a novel.
A novel? Okay. I might have to consult with my colleagues about this. Do you remember the title of this novel?
It had something in the title about war and our peace. Oh, doctor, what does this mean?
Calm down. Don't panic. It isn't as bleak as you think. War and Peace can now be seen on American movie classics. So he's not quite as sick as I originally thought.
Oh, good. But what about the fact that he's been taking walks and looking at his stamp collection?
And enjoying these activities?
Yes. Last night he wanted to talk about politics instead of watching Antique Roadshow.
I understand your frustration. Your husband has all the classic symptoms of what we call television withdrawal syndrome, or TWS. Doctors now know that TWS is caused by CRD, cathode ray deprivation. I've seen dozens of cases of CRD, and usually it's the rest of the family that suffers. Surprisingly, the patient is oblivious to his or her own degeneration, and sometimes will even try to infect the others in the family.
Am I in danger?
Unfortunately, there's no way I can answer that right now. We don't really know how CRD is spread, whether it's through word of mouth or some other form of contact. Do you have any small children?
No, all our children are grown up.
Any grandchildren who come to visit?
Oh, yes, we see them every weekend.
I wouldn't minimize the amount of time your grandchildren spend with your husband. Children can be easily susceptible to new ideas.
It just all so sordid and sick. There's nothing you can do for him?
Well, by this stage in the disease, the person has to really want to get well. The most insidious thing about TWS is that it lulls its victims into thinking that they are living a better life than they used to. Here's a number of a support group that may help. They're called FFPSFCRD/TWS, Friends and Family of People Suffering from Cathode Ray Deprivation/Television Withdrawal Syndrome.
Oh, thank you. How often do they meet?
They only meet in the summer and only when there are no Seinfeld reruns.
Well, that just sounds wonderful.
Here are also some back issues of TV Guide. You can offer these to him as often as needed. There are no side effects. Call me if he starts doing the chores or getting more sleep. That could be a sign that he's entered the last stages of the disease and will require some drastic measures. Otherwise, good luck.
But doctor, I have a few more questions to ask you.
Sorry, they're showing ER episodes in the doctor's lounge.
Oh.
I need a pass.
Guys, it's great. Let's look at these.
Why is this commercial? Why is this commercial? Why is this commercial?
You've been listening to Fear Itself on Mind's Eye Radio, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Gay Davidson-Zilski, Charlotte Quo Benitez, Dick Radke, Fran Rall, Sue Renard, Karen Schultz, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, Kelly Warren, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. The Mind's Eye players included Charlotte Quo Benitez, Fran Rall, Kelly Warren, and Greg Willard. If you would like a copy of this show or would like some more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525 or catch our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. That's Mind's Eye Audio, all one word and no apostrophe, .com. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Scott Tallman. Pray for a brave heart that does not fear death, that places a long life last among the gifts of nature.